Okay.
Okay, thank you all for coming. All of a sudden, I sense an aura about this room. Maybe that's because we have an eighth generation rabbi and the head of a long lineage of Buddhist spiritual tradition with us tonight. And we're really excited, and we hope you can begin. We have Rabbi Erwin Kula and Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche. And can you begin by telling us a little bit about your backgrounds and where you're coming from?
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, we have about 45 minutes, and then rock and roll starts, which is actually completely American, so that's perfect. So it's going to be rapid spirituality, or kind of, you know, freeze-dried spirituality. So I guess, though, it does come down to that if you can't do it in 10 or 20 minutes, it doesn't get done in America anyhow. So rather than maybe... I am who I am, he is who he is, and that's already a big accomplishment. And so maybe I'll just do a little introduction. I'm going to speak for about 10 minutes, and then the Sakyong will speak for 10 minutes. And then what we really want is, you've been talked at a lot in the Ideas Festival today, and it was a great day. Maybe we'll open up for questions and allow a kind of free-flowing questions about spiritual practice. And that's what we wanted to do. I had the opportunity of meeting the Sakyong last September, and... there was a very special chemistry in that, being an eighth generation rabbi and being in a long lineage, and then being an American trying to figure out how to bring an ancient tradition into dialogue with contemporary America, a lot of very similar kinds of issues. And we come from very different backgrounds, and yet very common issues. We were able to finish each other's sentences on a very long conversation on the phone, and then meeting in Boulder. And we thought that if we could push it through at the Ideas Festival, which we managed to do, that, and actually maybe that in of itself makes this an incredibly sacred moment. If anyone would have told the founders of the Aspen Institute that somewhere in 2007? That somehow those founders, there would be a day in which an eighth generation rabbi and a teacher from long line in a Buddhist tradition would be talking about spiritual practice under the auspices of the Aspen Institute. Well, those people are definitely turning around in their graves, without a doubt. And at the belly up, right? Right. So we have a lot of things that we're mixing here. But so first, I think that's worth taking in. There's something going on in worldwide, but surely in America, in which one way of understanding what it means to be a human being, and we can call that modern, or we can call that a kind of rationalistic, not rational, but rationalistic, scientistic, a kind of a material read of reality, exhausts reality, that I think we're all beginning to recognize, and that there are other dimensions. And just like we can go to quantum reality, and you've heard about that in the Aspen Institute of Science, and you can talk about galaxies, there's also an interior life. And that interior life, if it's not dealt with, we get into a lot of problems. And almost all the problems that we have, and I'm going to quote Einstein now because it's appropriate, with Walter Isaacson having written an amazing book on Einstein, that, you know, you can't solve, and it's a very famous line, you really can't solve problems from the same consciousness that created the problems. And we're trying to solve problems simply on a political level, very important, an economic level, very important, geopolitical, all the different levels that we try to address life's concerns. But there is this other level and this other line of development called the spiritual line of development. And sometimes I think that we need a massive shift in consciousness, but the only way we can shift consciousness is shift consciousness. And that means we almost have to be changing the tires of the car while the car is moving, and the car is moving very, very fast. And I think that's what we want to try to do a little bit tonight, is to talk about spiritual practice, how it works for us. Maybe if we have the time to demonstrate a little bit, or to invite you into a practice. And we're going to urge you, I'm now done, and going to urge you to ask questions, to think about the questions that you want. And because at 9 o'clock, you know, we turn into the pumpkins. And I wore orange in advance of that.
So, yeah, this is unusual for me, too. I have not been, and I met Rabbi Kula last year, and we had a wonderful discussion. And So I think one of the key things that I just try to express is that even though I'm coming from a long lineage of meditation and Buddhism, I've sort of grown up in a bicultural situation. And being a Tibetan Lama, there was a great, obviously, exodus from communist China. The Tibetans left, went to India, and many Tibetan Lamas at the forefront of His Holiness Dalai Lama. And I think one of the things that I find myself is being brought up in this bicultural situation, I would say it's a bicultural, spiritually speaking, also kind of, you know, West and East. But I was brought up in a situation where spirituality was a very kind of common aspect of everyday life. And so meditation was never considered to be spiritual because just the way you train the body in terms of exercise and diet, you have to have some nutrition for the mind and you have to deal with the mind. So I find these days there's a lot of interest in terms of meditation, what it can do, and a lot of the meditation that I know that I've presented is not even Buddhist meditation, but it's really addressing the key theme of that we have a mind, we have a heart, and an incredible amount of stress is put on it. And as I travel around the world, I just came back from Nepal and India, and we were doing some retreats there for several months, but even there, the monks and nuns is more stressed out. It's just the whole world is becoming more kind of with the phones, and you know, it's becoming a much tighter situation. And I think one of the things is that our mind and heart take on all this sort of negativity and a lot of stress and so forth. So it's come to this particular time, we're at a crossroads, where how do we address these issues? And it's not divided by, I think what you're saying is, it's just not a material thing, there's a spiritual aspect to it. And I think we sort of have to redefine what that kind of spirituality is from all traditions. And I think that's sort of what we're trying to share here. And I think right now with this kind of current climate and sort of ideas, and what I'm interested in is ideas, but how do you put them into action? And I have people who have been practicing meditation. My father was a great teacher, he taught here. And I sometimes have some of his students, you know, who've been practicing meditation for 30 years, and they say, you know, Rinpoche, I've been practicing for 30 years. I'm not enlightened. What happened? You know? And, you know, they're coming to me. I think they need a rabbi, actually. But there are so many
Jews involved.
they're coming to me, and I say, well, it's not my problem. And the other aspect is saying, I say, were you really practicing for 30 years, or were you sitting there kind of spacing out, hoping by osmosis it would somehow work? And I think that's sort of like the crux of the situation. Are we involved in our life? Are we involved in that kind of development and growth? So I think we're coming to a point where, what is it? Do we science, we have culture, we have spirituality, and how do they meet, and where is the meeting place? So I was interested in this discussion because when we were talking about our separate kind of inheritance, we're both coming to a crossroads of, and I feel it in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition where the older generation is passing away. In fact, this week is His Holiness Dalai Lama's birthday on the 6th. Mm. There's a big festival taking place. A lot of people are worried about the older generation passing away. A lot of them have. So that befalls on us, and I'm thinking about how do you take the next generation, can keep the continuity and keep that strength going. And it's not so easy. I don't think it's just because somebody before said so. And so I think it's brought us to this kind of situation because I think East is influencing West, West is influencing East. There's a lot of dynamics taking place.
Yeah, I know that one of the things that's challenging me now as a rabbi is I travel around the country, and in the last 8 months, I've actually been to 35 cities in the last 7 months on a book tour, and there seems to be this desire for practice that transcends group. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, I have this responsibility to my group. Mm-hmm. And the people who are most connected to the group are actually least interested in spiritual practice. Right. And the people most interested in spiritual practice are actually least connected to the group.
Yeah, right.
And that's part of that's part of how to hold this together in continuity. And the very experiences that I think we're looking for are about being a citizen of the planet in some new way. But to be a citizen of the planet, you have to also be a citizen of something and some location also. Yeah. And holding those two things together is increasingly complicated.
Yeah. I mean, from my understanding is when we talk about meditation and spirituality, people think, well, you're retreating from the world. But really the point is to kind of gain strength individually to re-enter into society. That's the point, is not to be separate. Now, a lot of people say, you Buddhists, all you're doing is meditating, and saying, oh, well, if that's all we did, that would be a problem. after the practice of actually gaining strength, you're supposed to re-enter society and with a more refreshed, strong, you know, experience. And so I think it's, but you know, you can't just do one, you have to have the other too. So.
Yeah. Sharon Salzberg, who's a founder of The Insight, you know, you know Sharon, we have a name in the Jewish community. We have a name for Sharon Salzberg. She's called a Jubu. I don't know if you know that Jubu. Or maybe it's a Buju. I don't know. I don't want to. But Sharon said that she was taking a lama from Asia around, and she had been with him for about a week. And he says to her, "Listen, I have a question about what's going on in America. I don't know if you've heard this story. Mm-hmm. I have this question about what's going on in America. In Asia, right?" When we teach, we start with generosity, morality, and only then, on the most serious level, meditation.
Right, right.
And here what we do is, it seems to be, they start with meditation and they never get to morality or generosity.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the disconnect in spiritual practice altogether in America. I was thinking about it as I was actually walking here tonight. I said, you know, in some respects, the Jewish problem is spiritual practice winds up turning into tribalism. Mm-hmm. And so you have a spiritual practice in which you have some beginning experiences, at least some sort of whatever we mean by peak experiences and certain states of consciousness and awareness. And then you come back into a kind of tribal awareness, and then it's, wow, yeah, oneness, my tribe.
Right.
And that's a kind of Jewish, that's the Jewish pathology of spiritual practice. And then I was thinking, and so what's the problem on the Buddhist end for a lot of the people that I meet is exactly what you said. It turns into this kind of detachment from the world, which is not what it's about. It's
right.
A re-engagement in the world with a greater generosity, greater compassion. You know, we're going to speak about compassionate leadership in the Middle East, almost an oxymoron. We're going to speak about that on Thursday morning. So it's this, how do you get all the lines moving at the same time? I mean, ultimately, the metrics of any spiritual practice is, are you more compassionate than you were yesterday?
Right.
Otherwise, you're fooling yourself.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there is a, you know, it's a complete package. You're supposed to have all the elements. And it's a matter of sometimes if people in this culture, I think meditation appeals because there's so much stress going on.
Mm.
And there's so much intensity of the mind. So the meditation can relieve that. But like in Tibet, if somebody's going to go meditate, we say they're brave, because they're going to do something that is challenging, and they're dealing with, in a sense, the most important thing or the difficult thing, which is one's own mind and how you develop that. But then, you know, in Tibet, the word for meditation is familiarity. So we use the word meditation here, but it means familiarity. And it means, what do you want, you know, your mind is always, like what I like to think about it is that sometimes people tell me, I meditate or I do not meditate. And I say, I understand what you're saying, but in the real definition of the word, we're all meditating. Because our mind is always getting used to something. So is it getting used to anger? Is it getting used to worry?
Jealousy.
Anything, you know. So when you do that, we just embody that element. So from a Buddhist point of view, it's saying, what's the best thing for your mind to get used to? And so that's the period where you develop that aspect. And I think what society demands is that we get out of bed automatically or able to be compassionate and so forth without having developed it. And so I think that's the disconnect with the mind and the body, because the body, you can make sense, but the mind you can't see and doesn't make sense. So that's sort of the, I like to think about it as the demystification of the practice. You know, otherwise, people are sitting there and they don't know what they're doing.
Right. They think they're seeking something.
Yeah.
But that's not how it works. It's actually to be able to have a certain kind of, whereas my daughter, who she's 15 years old, and she's very much into, she's transcending the Jewish people at the moment. She's in that stage. In fact, the other day I had a very, very major supporter of my organization and at the table on the Sabbath, and he was going through he was saying, and my daughter turns to him and says, "Do you really believe what you just said?" And he says, "This is not about anything that you said. Here's what it's about." And she described this character who lives on our corner named Robert. In New York City, everybody has every block has its own homeless person, in a way. And she said, "Did you notice him?" And the guy, I hope he doesn't lower his gift to our organization. but then Talia went into this riff at the table where, "Don't tell me about your prayer life," she said. I don't do that anymore because I don't believe in God. She's in that stage. And which is actually the most religious stage and spiritual stage there is, to demystify. When you say demystify, you know, meditation, it's also to demystify this, you know, God in the sky, which you don't have actually a problem with that,
right, yeah.
which is a good thing. Yeah. So you're a little ahead of us on that. But she said, the real practice is, can you actually, every single time you walk in the street, notice what's going on? And the guy said, like, what should I do? So she said, I want you to get a roll of quarters. This is what she said to the guy, and I'm taking notes, you know. And it's, I want you to get a roll of quarters, and I want you to put the roll of quarters in your pocket. And I want you to give out the roll of quarters by the end of every single day. And she says, and if you do that, and she used Jewish language of a mitzvah, which is the practice. And if you do that every day, then next time you come to our house, I want to hear how you talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that part of it is we think there's this spiritual practice of escaping something or some kind of ecstatic euphoria, and it's not. It's actually no different than right now,
just
more clear.
Yeah, I think that's a very hard message to communicate, and I think people don't want to hear it. They want to be in alternate states. And, you know, I say, you know, there's nothing's going to help if you're in an alternate state from that point of view. You know, this is what we have to deal with. And I think from that point of view, what is true spirituality is actually the union of actually, you know, what's happening and what's happening right now. And I think from the point of view of you know, my tradition, the whole point is to actually somehow benefit others. But like you're saying, you know, it's just not an easy thing to do. And I think a lot of people say, well, how do you do it? I said, part of the practice is figuring out how to do it.
Right.
Like, you know,
right.
With the quarters is like, you know, how do you actually put it into... Now, when we get up in the morning, we figure out what we're going to do about ourselves. What are we going to do about others? And so how does that transformation take place? But, you know, I think it's sort of, you wake up and the way I like to think about it is you're proactive in your spiritual tradition. You're engaging in it instead of waiting for it to come to you or have some deep realization. Because I think people sit or they do something or prayer and they keep waiting. And, you know, we have a saying in the Tibet, and they say, if you're without knowing what you're doing in meditation, your meditation is like a rock at the bottom of the lake. And they say, what happens to a rock at the bottom of a lake in 100 years? It's still a rock at the bottom of a lake, meaning nothing is going to happen unless you are personally engaged in that way.
Right. Let's, you know, I don't know how much time we have, but I'm sure it's not too much. So why don't we open up questions? And I don't know if, can the lights go up on a little bit? Because we don't need to be on stage this way. That's great. And if anybody, you know, maybe there's a question, and then we'll kind of riff off that. What is spiritual practice? Define it for us. So maybe you can, maybe we want to do something. Do you want to do a? I mean, again, we have a few minutes.
Sure.
And then I'll do something, and we'll see what happens.
You do something first. I do something. I mean, I think it's connecting with spirit, the mind, and the intention of the mind, the development of the mind, and I think it's having a purpose, and the purpose of, you know, we're here and there's a certain purpose and following that purpose instead of just being materially led around. So there's something deeper taking place. We get up, and I feel like unless we don't have, if we wake up without a purpose, that's when we start receding from life. We stop learning, and the mind needs to learn, the mind needs to develop, the heart needs to develop, emotionally, intellectually, everything. So, but we could do a brief meditation.
Meditation,
sure.
Yeah.
So this is the one thing I like to say is that meditation is just sort of a normal extension of your life. And basically what you're doing is training or developing, the way I like to think about it, one of the most important aspects of who you are, and that is the mind itself. So meditation means familiarity. And in Tibetan we say gom. And that just means you get familiar with right now what is helpful. And in the beginning, what's most helpful is to have kind of a relaxed, steady mind and not to be thinking about the past and the future. So as we do that, we become more present. And the reason why we say we want to be present is the present is the moment that determines the future. We can determine what's going to happen in the future by thought and action now. A lot of times we are not present. We are already ahead or back. So the meditation, this first meditation is called calm abiding, peacefully abiding. And that means just harmoniously being. So if we would, and you can, obviously we're sitting in chairs, so that's fine. And you can just sort of take a decent posture, and the mind and the body have a good relationship. So the mind and the body, like if you hold your body a particular way, your thoughts go a certain pattern. So this kind of upright posture is a way to relax the mind. And instead of thinking about the past and the future, we take our attention to and familiarize ourselves with what is present, and what's present is the breathing, hopefully. So we're breathing. So we're breathing out, and we're breathing in. And this is probably the most effective meditation for reducing stress, being clear, being strong. So the way we do it is just simple posture. The mind has been constantly engaged in thought, hearing, seeing, touching, and we're giving it a rest. And the way I like to think about it is just like exercise. You're strengthening it. You bring your mind back to the breathing. And the breathing is consistent, simple. And one thing I like to say is don't be fooled by the inactivity. It's one of the most potent things we're doing. And these days, there's a lot of scientific research about this kind of meditation. As our mind begins to relax and be more focused, it affects the brain, the organs. So it's just that quiet, simple period in the day. So exhale out. And breathe in. The mind is thinking about something. Just say, right now, I'm not going to be thinking about those. Just paying attention to the breathing. This gives us self-awareness. This is the first stage of putting thought into action. So as we begin to slow down, our senses begin to be more present. Just feeling the breath. It's very simple, but very potent. And we breathe in. And the point here is to get a sense of your mind without it drifting off, without spacing out, and really gaining ownership of our mind. If our mind is our own mind, we should be able to sit here just quietly for a few minutes. Developing awareness, mindfulness, contentment, intelligence, discipline, exertion. So thank you. I don't know if Rabbi, you want to probably, I don't want to torture people.
I'm sure that's the first meditation ever happened in Belly Up.
Yeah. Maybe that's why they call it Belly Up.
Yeah, Belly Up, right. I'll get another question, then I'll also answer the spiritual practice. Somebody back there, we can't really see, so okay, over there, middle, right in the middle there, but out loud.
Excuse me.
Louder.
So the mind is actually seen as a culprit. And in a lot of our scriptures, it is in the Hindu scriptures, it is described as a monkey that takes you here and there, and you know, it's right. Never still. So meditation and the first inroads into spirituality are actually seen as a stopping of the mind, a stilling of the mind, not really a development of the mind. So I just wanted to get,
I think it's stopping the discursive, uncontrolled mind. We say that the mind itself is coming in and out of existence, you know, at least 365 times in one snap of a finger. So it's a constant energy. So what happens is, it's impossible to stop the mind, but what you do is, in a sense, stabilize it. And it can feel like stopping the mind sometimes because all of a sudden there's a lot of space and we've been so embroiled in thought. But you have to gain kind of ownership or possession. And one of the main things in yoga is that you're doing the various yogic postures to get a subtle sense of the mind. And then once you have that, then you're supposed to meditate and develop that aspect. So then you have more like jnana yoga or wisdom yoga. So the first element is stabilizing it. But then what you want to do is develop in the direction you want it to take. But if you can't, you know, it's like in our tradition we say it's like a wild horse. If the mind has to be there, whatever you're doing, shopping, eating, spirituality, and if the horse get in the morning and it's a free-for-all, you're not sure where it's going to take you every day. And basically one day it's worrying, next day it's anger. You can't really develop it, so you have to gain some kind of ownership or possession. So, you know, it's a way, it depends on how you talk about the notion of stillness. Because experientially it can feel like that way, but ultimately it's not going to be that still. But it's usable, that's what I would think.
I think it's in the Jewish tradition, it's a combination of carving out inner space, so that's the stillness, and it feels very, very open because most of the time everything's so cluttered. But then there is a developing piece of it, and that is, what really are you going to marinate your consciousness in? One of my teachers says, consciousness is like tofu. What is tofu? That's good for Aspen, right? What does tofu taste like? What does it taste like? Nothing. And so tofu is completely dependent on what it is you marinated in. And so, now, first of all, you have to have the tofu, and if it's all messed up, and if it's all cluttered, and then all the marinade's not gonna work. But first you have to get it to tofu, but then actually you have to marinate it in something. And we can be very proactive in what we marinate it in. And then I think the things we want to marinate it in is, you have a choice. Do we marinate it in gratitude, or do we marinate it in resentment? Do we marinate it in bitterness, or do we marinate it in compassion? And then there are different practices along those, and those practices are more kind of what we would call active, but they're no less active than meditation, which is incredibly active. Meditation takes incredible discipline. To meditate for 20 minutes every single morning takes incredible amount of discipline. I want to do a Jewish koan, okay? Because there's also a mind stretching element, because we get habitually into certain patterns of thinking, and part of it is, can we blow apart the way in which we're thinking? Not only can we be still. So there's a practice in which you take two pieces of paper. I urge you to do this. You take two pieces of paper. On one piece of paper, a little piece of paper, you say, right, the entire cosmos was created for me. Which means, if you think about it, let's say it's 14 billion years. Okay, 14 billion years has unfolded, just to wrap your mind around it. We can't wrap our mind around it, and that's part of it. That just, wow, 14 billion years, and it's all to this moment right here, me. And then, just so you don't get too arrogant, the other piece of paper, you write on the other piece of paper, and you put it in your pocket, and I am just dust and ashes. Now hold those two things together. Put one piece of paper in one pocket and the other piece of paper in the other, and use it as a, you know, you're at that meeting, and whether you're, let's say you're the boss, you know, and you have this incredible sense of superiority over your worker, you know, or you're at a meeting and you cannot believe how many stupid things are being said at the meeting, right? And then as you think that, because it's about getting in control of what it is you're marinating your consciousness in, because it's amazing how the first thought, that person really is stupid, it's amazing how that thought generates a whole cycle of stupid thoughts. And And then at the end of the day, you come home and you're not happy with your spouse. And you're not happy with your children. And you drive home and you're cursing someone in traffic. That's the power of this when the Sakyong says the present moment creates the entire future. This is rocket science. It takes discipline, but it's not rocket science. That is what happens. So at that moment, just remember, you're just dust and ashes. You know, you take out that piece of paper, oh yeah, right. You know? And then those moments when actually, you know, you're not figuring out who you are and living up, and you don't feel like you're successful. The whole world's created for me. What's my purpose right now? Yeah. And it's holding those two things together, and and which one's true? Well, of course, both are true always. It's just a matter of which truth when, is always, you know.
I like the tofu thing.
You can use it.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think the mind is neutral that way. And one thing that I would almost go further with the analogy is saying, if you don't pick your marinade, somebody else is going to pick the marinade.
Yeah, right.
And
great.
So basically, your mind is neutral, and whatever, if you don't take care of it, you're going to be in an environment that could be toxic or could be jealousy or, you know, whatever is kind of coming up. So I think from a point of view, sometimes I feel like we feel like we can go into the world and not be touched in a sense, unless, you know, because the world is doing this. But in fact, as we go along, we are being sort of affected by every environment. And then that's the way I like to think about meditation is that, well, what direction do I want to take it? Because unless I take it this way, somebody or something is going to take it another way. So at the end of the day, you don't know why you feel resentful because you're not sure what you did, but you feel that way because that's the environment that's happened in the mind. You know?
Yeah, so here's maybe a final practice because it's an evening practice, and I can see them on the side, so we'll have to do this quickly. An evening practice, and you can do it when you get home, and it's really just a forgiveness inventory. And one of the things that happens is there's a lot of, you know, it's like build up, you know, things build up all the time. No one has complete control here of what is you're even taking in. So sometimes you have to kind of do an inventory and clean things up. And there's a Jewish practice before going to sleep, a forgiveness inventory, in which literally you go through your day and ask, you know, I ask myself, okay, you know, who really did get on my nerves today? Who did I get angry at today? And it's amazing, people that I didn't even know I was angry at come to mind. Because we're not even aware sometimes of the emotions that are coming at us. Right. And they go so fast. And then think about, and again, what I do is, I imagine the first thing, and this comes from a text in the book of Leviticus, that before you criticize someone else, because whatever you see in someone else, even if it happens to be true, whatever that means, the only reason you can see it is because it's in you, says the Talmud. So the very first thing when I'm angry at someone in that evening practice is, wow, what did I do to contribute to that moment? Doesn't mean that the person didn't do something wrong. Okay? Again, everything is within context. And you go through, let me tell you, it allows dreams to be a very, very different experience. And it's a forgiveness inventory. These are not complicated as much as you have to do it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen if you don't do it. And it's not about it that it works. It's not, there's nothing different except that everything is different. Do you know what I mean? Nothing is different. Nothing is different at all except that it's different. And so there's a forgiveness practice. And the last practice is what I call, that I'll share is it's called Dayenu. Dayenu, for the Jews in the room, you know, Dayenu is it's actually a song sung on Passover, but it's actually a meditation, and it's a gratitude meditation. And Dayenu means, it would be enough. It would be enough. But it's a very subtle practice because actually what it suggests is you have to always be wanting it all and always be finding enough. And if you're just finding enough, you're selling yourself short. But if you're simply always wanting it all, you're going to be really resentful. Mm-hmm. So you actually have to always be wanting it all and always be finding enough. Mm-hmm. And training yourself to do that is a really interesting thing to do. Mm-hmm. And here's the practice, and it's an evening practice too. It's also pre-bedtime. It's called Dayenu, and you go through your day, and it goes like this: if the only thing that happened today was that I got up and was able to kiss my daughter goodbye, but you know, the business deal didn't happen, it would have been enough. If the only thing that happened today was that I was able to see the sun rise, and it's a beautiful day, and I smelled the... it would be enough. If the only thing that happened, try to do about 50 of them. 49 is actually the... but try to do 49 of those. By the way, the first 10 are not so hard, right? The 49th, it stretches you, and that begins to marinate the consciousness in a type of gratitude. And here's I think, kind of like a very important, I think, at least for me, that I've learned from the Jewish tradition is you can never get enough of what you don't really need. And this is a good Aspen teaching. It really is, and I mean it respectfully because I'm inside. It's, you can never get enough of what you don't really need. And there is a yearning we have. And that yearning, it's great to go to the refrigerator and eat, and it's great to shop, and it's great to vacation, and it's great to hike and bike. And all of those things are central in developing who we are. But none of them can satisfy this other hunger that we have. That hunger is only satisfied actually being a little bit aware, you know, the way we're talking about. I think, you know, being a touch more generous and a touch more compassionate. So if the only thing that happened today was that I got to sit on belly up stage with the Sakyong, one of the great teachers in America, if that's the and worldwide actually, if that's the only thing that happened today, Dayenu, it would be enough.
Am I 49er?
All right, one more question, and I think that's it. Is that right? Back there, I see her. Is that... what time is it? Oh, we're doing great. Oh, fantastic. Good. Okay. I don't want to get thrown off. I'd like to leave before.
I want to tell both of you that you changed my life, and you don't know it. In September, at the Shambhala retreat in northern Colorado for the Dalai Lama celebration, I met both of you. My name is Susan Thomas. Mm-hmm. I'm a 15-year Aspenite. I now describe myself as Methodist leaning Buddhist. Mm-hmm. And
we'll get the Jewish in there.
Yeah.
and I completely respect and honor the Jewish faith as well. It was a life-changing experience for me. After I left that retreat, I bought 2 books at that retreat that involved both of you. And I started a foundation as a result of being there and reading those books. Right. I went to Cambodia. I started a foundation called Safe Place in Cambodia. I am now supporting 36 young women at risk in safe houses, doing food, room board education, health care, and sewing training centers for 28 young women. The sewing training center is... so my question is this: how can you inspire the rest of us in this room tonight to do a project like this that is now my life's mission, without going through a 3 or 4 day retreat with you?
I see. Not bad, huh?
That was rhetorical.
Right? Yeah. Right.
No, we're very...
That's wonderful. Yeah.
You know, it's not... believe it or not, there's a great passage in the Talmud that says, when you're ready, a blade of grass can be a teacher. So, you know, at that moment, you were ready, and so blades of grass could be teachers. And, you know, you can't be where you can't be there before you're there. And part of it is we put a certain pressure on ourselves. I'll tell you a story that really was for me when I had the opportunity to meet His Holiness. And it was a very, very small group, and And this is a funny story, actually. I never even told the Sak Yang this because I'm a little embarrassed, but what's the difference? So, being from the Upper West Side of Manhattan and Jewish and raised in a super intellectual home, I spent about 2 hours preparing the question I was going to ask the Dalai Lama, because, of course, I wanted His Holiness to think I was smart. Which just goes to show that spiritual practice is a funny thing, even for 8th-generation rabbis. And of course, I walked into the stupa, and it's worth going to Feather Lake. Feather Lakes, is that what it's called?
Red
Feather Lakes. It's really a remarkable place. It stays with you forever. First of all, it was an amazing experience. But then, by accident, the His Holiness said something about the Muslim rabbi, and that's a new term. And he began to laugh. He has this beautiful laugh, right? He began to laugh. And when he came off the stage, and it was freezing, when he came off the stage, he hugged me, and he apologized. He said, "I know you're not a Muslim rabbi." and I said to him, "One day when it's working right, that'll be a term everyone knows." And so he smiled. But when we walked in, I of course forgot my question, and. And here's what happened, and I think this relates to you. It's so you bow, and then I looked at him, and here was my experience. I didn't even tell you this. My experience was, for a moment, I felt all my uchiness, okay? And I have plenty. All my kind of, it was like nothing in particular, but everything. Imagine a very kind of dirty mirror. And that's all of it. That's the greed and the envy and the ambition and all the stuff that's out of control. And I kind of saw it all, and I had this like petrified, it was all in a billionth of a second. Billionth of a second of unbelievable embarrassment. And precisely at that moment, I mean literally, it's all this is I'm describing you what was a billionth of a second experience. Precisely at that moment, I had, it's perfectly okay. And then immediately and you can do better. And I think that's, if you say, that was to me like the Jewish lesson, obviously it was coming from His Holiness, that we're perfect just the way we are, and we can be tweaked quite a bit. And if you can hold those two things together, see, I don't believe that you can be inspired until actually you feel secure enough to be inspired. Because to make real change in your life is incredibly difficult. So you have to be actually already, relatively speaking, pretty together. Otherwise, it's going to be built on trauma, and that's no good either. So it's perfect just the way you are, and you could be tweaked, you know.
Yeah, I remember that when he was introducing, meeting everyone, and then he said the Muslim rabbi, and he immediately goes, "Oops, big mistake."
Big mistake, right?
He's in front of thousands of people, and he's a world leader here, and he's gotten the basic question mixed up, you know? And then it was a kind of a great moment because everybody laughed, and then it's like we all have our mistakes and everything, but it's all kind of, you know, okay and workable in that particular way. So it was a beautiful teaching. Right. And I don't know, the thing that I've come to realize is that we are, I don't think it's just a matter of if you don't do a 3-day retreat or not, but a lot of times you do have those 3-day retreats, but then you forget it easily. And how do you move on? And I feel like, you know, nowadays we need to take a certain one of the things that I always try to say is like just a 10% change in attitude. So it's like you can just 10%, you can say, "I'm going to be kinder," and so forth, 90% pissed off and irritated.
Yeah.
But if you have that one little bit, if you try to do it all at once, it doesn't work.
Yeah, I think that's right. Perfection is the enemy of the good a lot of times.
Yeah, and it gets in the way because you think, "I failed now," because all of a sudden you get mad. Well, the reality is that, you know, one moment when you're about to meet somebody, you have a moment saying, "Actually, this is my life, this is my path. How do I want to do it a little bit differently?" And so that's a quiet moment. That's your path. No one's going to hear about it. But it's a little by little it begins to change because there is no big change, you know. And I know this because I was brought up in this tradition. I haven't found it yet. So you know, it's you sit there and you work with these subtle changes. But I think, you know, you do have to come to the point where you realize you have enough confidence to say that's okay. And that, you know, it may take forever, but that's okay.
So. Yeah. Okay, I see you're straight ahead there. But out loud.
Okay. My question is more of a comment than an observation. But I really am struck by the similarities between Judaism and Buddhism, and I was wondering if you could comment on that. And one of the things that I wanted to say is that I was just in Israel, and while I was there, I learned that in Hebrew, the word for God is pronounced, it's actually not pronounceable, and it's, when you try to pronounce it, it's like making a breath, like that, which struck me very as important in the Buddhism and in yoga as well. So I thought that maybe you could comment on the similarities between the two religions.
I mean, I think there's a lot of these days, you know, there's so much that's commonly human. And then there's different, you know, each tradition has its thing. And different conferences I've been to, whether it's a Christian Buddhist conference or different traditions, I mean, there's certainly differences because the traditions have been growing for thousands of years. But there, at this point, there's so much, I would call it common sense, and a lot of common sense basis in terms of, like in Buddhism, we say, you know, of course you have to have some kind of way to handle your mind and heart and emotions. Otherwise, if you're going to go on a long spiritual journey, you're not going to last. So it's, you know, how do you do that? And whether it's in Judaism, everybody has the same mind. Everybody has the same. So it's understanding that principle. And what I'm curious also is that at what point do you kind of keep the integrity of what mm-hmm. you have and then share so that you can actually benefit each other and also it creates a more friendly environment in the world. And so this is something that we've both been dealing with because I can't say, well, my tradition no good and forget about it. There's many, many people behind it. At the same time, there's clearly a development that needs to take place in terms of, because if we can't kind of understand, you know, it doesn't look too good.
Right. No, I mean, this is it's this constant ongoing dilemma. Part of what you heard is, in other words, how many people in Hebrew school got taught that God, the name for God is unpronounceable. It's not anthropomorphic. It means in the Hebrew, first of all, pronouncing is just breath, which, I mean, think the Sakyong just did a meditation on breath. In Judaism, he's what we would say, he's godding. You understand? That's, we wouldn't say he's many, he's literally godding because that's the breath. So in that respect, but that's not what we're taught in Hebrew school. We're taught in Hebrew school that there's this voyeuristic peeping Tom God in the sky who's rewarding and punishing if you're not, if you intermarry, you know, and that's a very low level way of teaching Judaism. And so, but I think that this is one of the great problems in Jewish life, one of the great problems and why there has been such enrichment in the conversation and dialogue and what I call the missions into the Buddhist community and the Buddhist tradition that so many Jews have done, is that in the great thing about the 21st century is we can enter other people's traditions with respect, mm-hmm. know full well that they're not ours. And don't fake it. I love it. If you read almost all the Dalai Lama's books, at the very beginning, he says, I don't ask you to become Buddhists. Yeah. And he's so careful about that.
In fact, he prays.
Right? No, it's a very powerful thing that he does in the book. But what we can do is we can cleanse or enhance where our own traditions maybe evolved for a variety of historical and contingent reasons, you know, in ways that don't work anymore. But how do you have, at the same time, a kind of respect and integrity? And there's no line. There's no, like, perfect line. Here's the authentic line. It's grappling with it all the time. Another way of saying it is, you know, everybody needs food, but what really makes it interesting is there's a lot of different kinds of foods. And if there was only one food and you were an astronaut, maybe it's okay in space, but not so much fun. And being human is really, really complicated. And at the same time that it's very simple. And so what we need is as many tools, technologies, and methods as we can. And I think that one of the things in the 21st century that's freaking out most religions is, the fact is, if this, as I say as a rabbi now, if these tools are not working for you as a Jew, then you really need to explore. Because it is not about, for you, it is about your life. Mm-hmm. I may have certain responsibilities regarding the inherited tradition that I have to work with, but it's about your life. And we have to open it up a little bit that way, and both traditions will benefit them. Finally, I think one of the most important commonalities is right now they have very serious diaspora or exile components. And that's not an insignificant thing, to be exiled from your land and be able to still survive is a very, very difficult challenge. And in that respect, I think Jews and Buddhists, it's not an accident if you know, we're managing to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. It's time.
Thank you.